Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast. On Primetime Politics, breaking rank.
It's a big job. I'm enjoying it, and I'm optimistic that our team and the Prime Minister will make the case to Canadians.
The public safety minister says he is ready to follow the prime minister into another campaign, but does not rule out a leadership run for himself. With Justin Trudeau trailing badly in the polls, we'll speak to our journalist panel about grumblings of a liberal leadership change. Also.
And we're making the kinds of investments that will be key to unlocking immense economic potential.
As Trudeau and his cabinet fan across the country to sell his latest budget, we'll speak with former Liberal Finance Minister John Manley about his concerns regarding the path Justin Trudeau is taking. And the British High Commissioner to Canada, Susanna Goshko, on the importance of the Canada-UK relationship and protecting democracies around the world. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. It's no secret that Justin Trudeau is trailing in the polls, trailing for well over a year and trailing badly since last summer when Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives opened up a double-digit lead over the Liberals and have not looked back. It has led to recurring questions about the Prime Minister's leadership and reportedly led a close friend to consider his own leadership aspirations once again. Take a listen to what we heard from the Public Safety Minister, Dominic Leblanc, earlier this week.
Do you plan to run for Liberal leader?
No, I plan to be a candidate in the next election under Prime Minister Trudeau's leadership. I'm very happy. I'm excited about that. I'm focused on the responsibilities he gave me.
Well, to discuss the matter, we're now joined by our weekly journalist panel. Robert Fife is the Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Stephanie Levitz, the Deputy Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. And Joël Denis Bellevance, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for La Presse. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hello.
So, you know, we all heard it, Dominic Leblanc saying that the next election is for the Prime Minister to lead, but he's not denying any type of meeting he's had to explore his own options. You know, what does this say about unity within the Liberal ranks, or at the very least, the questions being asked about the future of the Prime Minister right now? Bob?
Well, we all know that everybody in the minister's offices who want to run for the leader have been talking about this for many, many months of whether he's going to stay or go. They all want him to go. Nobody's going to say that publicly, but the writing is on the wall because Mr. Trudeau's approval ratings, the Liberal Party's approval ratings, are really in the dumps. And a lot of people feel that should he leave, that would open the door to the possibility the Liberal Party can come back. Even though Mr. Poilievre is way ahead in the polls, it's not necessarily means that people like him, but they're just fed up with Trudeau. And another alternative might change the whole picture. We don't know that. I mean, you know, politics is like that. But it certainly is, given the fact that it was Dominic Leblanc, one of his best friends, one of the most competent cabinet ministers, a very smart, savvy political operator, who I expected him, after that column came out, he'd come out and say, no, I'm not interested in running at all. He didn't do that.
Yeah.
And that sent a real signal to everybody in the political establishment of, uh-oh, something is going on here.
Yeah, Stephanie?
I mean, if we take a broader view of it all, I suppose, and you think about the next election and you think about the reality that the Liberals could lose that election, should they lose that election, there is no way Prime Minister Justin Trudeau stays on as leader of that party. That is not so far away that if you are thinking you would like that job, you might want to get going now and start building teams and start sussing things out. Is it a show of disloyalty in the Prime Minister, or is it just pragmatic politics? Because we also have to look at what happened to the Harper Conservatives. One of the big knocks against Stephen Harper on his way out the door in 2015 is there was no succession plan. There was no discussion about what was going to happen when Mr. Harper inevitably was no longer leader of the Conservative Party. And where did that leave them? Five leadership races in 3 years is where it left them, and in the doghouse for a very long time among voters.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Denis?
Well, in the talk of Dominique Leblanc being interested in the leadership of the Liberal Party, I think we'll probably lead other candidates to maybe start talking thinking about it, or maybe organizing more openly about their ambitions. But we know that Mr. Le Pen was interested in the past in the leadership of the Liberal Party, ruled it out once Mr. Trudeau decided to go. But it surely does leave the door open for the candidates to organize. I heard some speculation that Mr. Trudeau will probably make a final decision, although he keeps saying that he's going to run again, but his final decision will come down after the end of this session. And then he will make a definite decision on his future. And if that's the case, that will leave enough time for Liberals to organize a leadership race, and probably, I'm assuming that Monsieur Leblanc will be part of the candidates who will be running. Because he's perfectly bilingual. I mean, he can go from French to English, and he would have some appeal in Quebec, and that's a key ingredient for the Liberal Party to limit the damage, if I may say, or rebuild after the next federal election.
Yeah, listen, I'll try to get Dominic LeBlanc an assessment of him in a moment. But, you know, it is one of these things where I kind of wonder what is the debate happening right now with the Prime Minister, because the Liberals have been trying to amend their agenda to reflect, you know, what why people are turning to the Conservatives, most recently with this budget, turning to Gen Z and millennials. I was going to say Gen X for my people, but Gen Z, you know, trying to turn it over. But really, when you look at the polling numbers, nothing seems to be working in terms of turning the numbers around. So I wonder about the internal debate in the Prime Minister's head and whether or not he can actually sell a policy that might turn things around for the party.
Well, look, I mean, they are really trying. They brought in new people in the Prime Minister's office, and he's taken a much more proactive social media message. If you watched him, they've also been much more critical, Liberals and their bots going after the Conservatives. And they've thrown everything, every bit of money they can at voters in the last couple of weeks as we led up to the budget. And so I think the thinking within the Prime Minister's office is, let's see how much we can chip down that strong lead by the Conservatives. The hope is to chip it down a 5 points a month if they can try to bring them down. But I don't think that's going to necessarily work, because I think people have stopped listening to Justin Trudeau. I think they're just fed up with him. And also the budget, it's got some good measures in it, but now we're starting to see a lot of real serious criticism about it from people who are affected by it. Doctors, for example, or people who want to sell their cottages, or entrepreneurs who want to invest in the innovation economy. That begins to undermine people's, are these guys really good at this anymore? They're good at spending money, but are they really good at getting policies out the door? And, you know, the housing measures, for example, they're fine ideas, but they're not going to work overnight. So, I just think that I think voters are fed up with Mr. Trudeau, and he's got to make a decision to think about the party rather than himself.
Yeah, and you know, to that, I remember when the Liberal had their caucus in London, Ontario, I was wondering, how good are they at reading the public opinion anymore? Because going in, they said, oh, everyone cares about the environment, everyone cares about the environment, and leaving, oh, it's all about housing. So what do you think about the discussions being happening right now as to whether or not they can continue to sell policy and turn things around?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. I suppose that all politics at the end, like the policy that comes out of politics, ought to be in response to the electorate, right? It ought to be in response to what people are saying they need from the government. The question is, do people with this suite of ideas in front of them from the Liberals, is that enough for them? Is that enough to say, okay, you know what, I believe it, you do in fact have my back, you are looking out for my best interest? Or, you know, as Bob says, are they just done caring, done trusting, done listening? All the pollsters, I think, were unanimous in saying this is a change election coming down the pipe. It just is. The Liberals will have been in power 10 years. No governments really last that long. It doesn't matter how much you throw at this. And so for the Liberals, and I think we all hear the same thing, they're pinning a lot of hopes in things outside of their control, right? They're hoping that interest rates come down. They're hoping that they can scare people off of Pierre Poilievre and his Conservative Party. They're to some degree hoping that people wake back up to the necessity of dealing with climate change in a meaningful way. How they sell a consumer price on carbon on that anymore, I don't know that they can. But they're just banking, I think, on, okay, well, if an election were held today, it is X, the election will not be held today. It will be held in 2025 at the earliest.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Denis?
The other thing that is, I think, an element to consider is that Mr. Trudeau has lost all provincial allies. And the last one standing was the provincial premier of Newfoundland and Labrador. There is, although the BC premier is an NDP, but I think he's an ally, Mr. Trudeau. But, you know, it's a difficult one because everybody's throwing throwing stones at him, even provincial premiers. And that's happening in the House of Commons. And more you will see the NDP here, the political ally of the Liberals, doing the same thing. So Mr. Trudeau might be thinking that he's the best one to sell the Liberal message, but you've got so many people throwing stones at you. People can't hear you because you're saying ouch all the time.
Yeah. Well, I can't mind back to 2015 when Stephen Harper was throwing all kinds of money at Canadians for that whole summer and in leading up to the election campaign, and it didn't matter to anybody. And he was also, you know, very disparaging of Mr. Trudeau as sort of some kind of a lightweight. Well, they're disparaging of Mr. Poilievre as some, you know, little Trumpian guy. I'm not sure any of this stuff works when you reach the end of your term.
You know, and quickly running time, so I'll turn to the two of you, because, you know, we talk about Dominic LeBlanc, but is anybody better than Trudeau at this point, including Dominic LeBlanc?
No. I mean, not necessarily. You could argue that there are people who are thinking about running for leadership that are bad communicators, that don't know how to work a room or a crowd, don't appear to be responding with people. I mean, say what you will about Mr. Trudeau, he's an excellent retail politician. You still need that skill, even with all the social. You need to be able to get out into a crowd and work them up. And I think that he still excels in that. When he gets that fight, that spirit going, he can motivate and animate people in a way that, I mean, it's possible Monsieur LeBlanc could do that with his sort of winsome charm that he sometimes displays and sharpness, but not anyone is better than Justin Trudeau. It's the question of the Liberal Party, to some extent, figuring out who would work in place of Justin Trudeau.
And I think the thing it goes also within the Liberal ranks that if we elect a new leader now, will we sacrifice our new leader for nothing? And that's the one of the element that the Liberals are thinking about. Do we have, if we have a new leader, will that leader do better? Or are we going to the slaughterhouse with a new leader and won't change anything? So that's part of the thinking that is going on. And we'll see. Mr. Trudeau still has some months to go. But I'm told that after this session, the big thinking will start for real.
Yeah, and I think part of that is the fact that no one expected them to win a majority government back in 2015 either. They were meant to be second before first. Mm-hmm. Last answer from you on the same thing. Do you think anyone is better than Trudeau, or is he?
No, I agree with Stephanie that, you know, Trudeau is the better candidate, and he's a very good retail politician, and you know, he has charisma, but it's run out. But there are people like François-Philippe Champagne who can come in here and, hello, you guys! He's like a little Gretchen, right? So, you know, don't discount him. I mean, Mélanie Joly is very warm personality. She's good as a politician in a room. She's different personalities, but it doesn't mean that he can be the salvation. We don't know what would happen when an election, if Mr. Trudeau leaves, because all of a sudden all the attention is paid by journalists in the country on who is going to be the next Liberal leader, and when they come in, there's usually a honeymoon period of time unless they really screw up, and that can change the whole dynamics of an election campaign. So, you know, I've seen this before, so let's wait and see if Mr. Trudeau walks the plank or decides to hang in and fall in the water.
Bob, Stephanie, Jean-Denis, thank you for this.
Thanks.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, federal ministers have fanned out across the country to sell the latest budget, answering questions as well about criticisms that have come out since the finance minister tabled it earlier this week.
We're asking those who are doing the very best, those who are working so hard and doing great things, you know, as Alain, our scientist and entrepreneur, is doing. People who are enriching our country with their work and are doing really well. We're asking those people to contribute a little bit more so that we can make the investments that Canadians need. That's what we're doing. It's the right thing to do.
And, of course, that was the finance minister in Toronto. Now, as I said, there are concerns about the latest federal budget. Chief among those concerns, the decision to increase the capital gains inclusion rate. And for more on this, we're now joined by former finance minister John Manley, former finance minister in the Gretchen government, these days chair of Jefferies Securities and a senior advisor at Bennett Jones. Mr. Manley, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, Michael.
Listen, the government, in expanding the inclusion rate for capital gains, they say it's being done essentially to be more fair, in particular older, wealthier Canadians being asked to pay more so that younger Canadians can get things like housing or a chance to save for a down payment for a house, and not to mention other programs. What's wrong with that type of reasoning?
Well, of course, fairness is always in the eye of the beholder. You're never going to get everyone to agree on what's truly fair. But I guess the way I approach some of these things, Michael, is to ask what problem we're trying to solve for. And we know the Prime Minister has been telling us, you know, regularly over the last number of months that you tax things you want to discourage. That's the justification for the carbon tax. We put a tax on it to reduce carbon emissions. That's reasonable. I get that. So what are we taxing here? We're taxing investment. We're discouraging investment. We're discouraging entrepreneurialism. And yes, some of the people that have that tax advantage are going to be older. No shame in that, I might say. And they might even be wealthier, but some will not be. But what we're telling that whole community of potentially young entrepreneurs that want to create the next big thing is we're going to take more of that money away from you than we're currently doing. And by the way, we're very close here to the United States, and you might find those tax rates much to your benefit if you start your new enterprise there. I just think that doesn't sound like the right problem to solve.
But if the rich don't pay more, doesn't that just increase income inequality? And at the end of the day, there are, as the government puts it, Canadians who are asking for these social programs.
Well, first of all, let's remember the rich do pay more. And the minister's justification for this was slightly, I'd say, misleading, because the rate of tax on capital gains is lower than the rate on ordinary income. But of course, all of the rates are progressive. And once you get to, you know, ordinary income of roughly $200,000 per year, you're paying a lot more. In the province of Ontario, you're paying almost 54% of your incremental income in tax. And if you look at the analysis of who's paying the tax, the more people that are earning more are paying a lot more. They're paying a lot higher rates, and they're paying a lot more money. So that's why it's very hard to go down this road of saying, well, what's fair? What's the right amount? You know, the finance minister for Louis the 14th in France once said that the art of taxation was to extract the largest number of feathers from the goose with the least amount of complaint from the goose's beak. And there's a point at which, when the government becomes the senior partner in an individual's economic relationship, then you discourage them from working. You may encourage them to move elsewhere. They are mobile. And you end up getting less revenue, not more. So my fear in this, remember, Michael, I was in the Liberal government in the 1990s. We actually brought that inclusion rate back down to 50% from 66 2/3%. The reason was it wasn't raising much money. And I think if you go back to the numbers, you'll see that at 50%, it actually raised more money than it did at 66 2/3%. Why? Because people would just sit on their assets. Why sell it? The government's going to take too much. And that's not the kind of intervention in the economy that's healthy. So I think it's a mistake.
You know, quickly running out of time, but I do want to ask you in the less than 1 minute I have, you know, the inclusion rate on capital gains is one thing. The other criticism this government is facing is the fact that it's laid out no path to balance. Does that still matter, do you think?
Well, I think it matters, and I'll give you just two numbers since we're short on time. One is government spending has doubled compared to the last year of the Harper government. And not only that, the carrying charges on our debt have also doubled, so that we're now paying as much interest on debt as the government is generating from GST revenue. Those are both worrying things because eventually the piper calls the tune, and you will have to make some cuts. That's what we went through in the 90s. It was unpleasant and it was difficult. Canadians largely supported it, but you don't want to get to that.
Mr. Manley, I appreciate the time this evening. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, as we continue with our program, we want to note that at the time of this taping, we are watching the situation in the Middle East very closely. On Thursday night, early Friday morning in Israel, a drone attack was launched against Iran. It targeted a military installation in the city of Isfahan, and while no Israeli official has claimed responsibility, the attack is seen as Israel's response to the hundreds of missiles and drones launched by Iran last weekend. So far, the reaction from Tehran has been muted, and we continue to follow the story for you right here on CPAC. For now, let's turn our attention to NATO. Earlier this month, I moderated a panel discussion at the National War Museum to mark the 75th anniversary of the military alliance. Among those who took part in the panel discussion, the British High Commissioner to Canada, Susanna Goshko. Now, after that event, I asked the High Commissioner if she would come to our studio to continue our conversation, and here now is the result. Well, we're now joined by the British High Commissioner to Canada, Susanna Goshko. Excellency, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you and I were speaking at the War Museum recently, talking about the 75th anniversary of NATO. And during that conversation, you noted the fact that climate change is essentially changing the calculus around security for countries like the United Kingdom and Canada. What exactly are the threats that change the calculus?
Yeah, well, it's an important question. So we've all made a commitment to keep global warming as close to 1.5 as we possibly can. But we know even if we succeed in doing that, and the challenges of us being able to do that are high, that there's going to be all kinds of changes to the way that the world is today that we're going to have to grapple with. The most notable is there's going to be increasing competition for resource, whether that's land to live on, whether that's water to drink, or whether that's food. All of that is going to become increasingly more, it's going to become a lot harder to secure, and it's going to lead to rising conflict. It'll lead to mass migratory flows, and all of that's things that we've got to prepare for. So that's what I was really talking about on Friday. But I would note as well that in your defence policy update that was just published on Monday, it talked about the Arctic and how much the Arctic is changing. And I think the statistic it used was that the Arctic is warming four times faster than any of the rest of the world. So there's a whole lot in this that I think we're really only just coming to terms with now. What's it going to mean? How do we prepare for it? And we were really delighted to see the reference to Canada's leadership in the Arctic, because that's going to be at the forefront of all of this.
Well, let's talk a bit more about that, because when you think about the historic alliances between the two countries, and of course Canada and the United Kingdom have a long history, our history as a modern country, really beginning with the United Kingdom and with France. But when you look at the military alliance in NATO, so much of it is focused on European defense. And now with climate change, in particular in the Arctic and the Canadian context, we now are looking north. And yet in the same ways, we're dealing with the same security challenge more north rather than just continental Europe.
Yeah, I mean, the point of NATO is that it's a defensive alliance for Euro-Atlantic security, and recognizing that threats to the alliance can come from many different places. It's not just about threats from within, but it's threats to that alliance. And so we have to think really holistically about what does that look like and how do we best prepare ourselves to face all of those challenges. And, you know, a changing Arctic is just one of them. It's one of the reasons why we're really keen to learn from Canadian experience. And we were really pleased to see some of the stuff in your defense policy update.
Mm-hmm. Now, one immediate challenge right now, of course, is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that has once again brought war to the doorstep of Europe. How important is the UK-Canadian alliance when you look at Ukraine and what it represents for really the continuation of liberal democracies?
Yeah, look, first of all, the first thing I want to say about Ukraine is that our view on this in the UK is totally clear. We must be with Ukraine until Ukraine prevails, because if we don't stop Putin in Ukraine, what we have seen time and time again is that he will come back for more. So stopping Putin now is not just the morally right thing to do for Ukraine, but it's actually the best way to invest in our own defence and security. And the UK and Canada have done a huge amount in this space together. I feel very proud of the work that we've done. So For example, we're working together on training Ukrainian troops in the UK. We've had a big program of training thousands of Ukrainians, actually Ukrainians who are going to go out and fight on the front line. Tens of thousands of them have now come through that program that the UK and Canada are running together. We've worked really closely together on things like sanctions, how we might apply those to maximum impact, and thinking about the different levers we've got, as well as our participation in NATO.
Are you worried then when you see the debate in the United States about whether or not the U.S. should continue funding Ukrainian military efforts? And even in this country, we saw earlier this year a poll from Angus Reid, which says that one in four Canadians now believe that Canada is actually doing too much to support Ukraine. Does that worry you?
Well, look, I think the first thing to say is that the US has spent huge amounts of money on Ukraine, and we need to recognize that they have been a really significant and important contributor, and we mustn't let the dialogue sort of hide the huge amount they have already done. It is, of course, really important that we all continue to do as much as we can. I think the point that I always try and make here is that point. I really strongly believe this, that if we don't invest the money now, the costs further down the line, both in financial and in human terms, will be much higher, because it's not just about Putin and stopping him now and stopping him in a way that means that he doesn't come back for more, but it's also about asking ourselves the question of who else is watching and what lessons are they drawing if we fail to stand up for what's right and what fundamentally is rooted in the UN Charter.
You know, a different topic here, because in January the UK walked away from the negotiating table when it comes to a free trade with Canada. I'm wondering where things stand now. What are the outstanding issues, do you think?
Well, I always try and make clear here that we have a brilliant trading relationship with Canada. We have businesses on both sides of the Atlantic that are operating seamlessly, and we have a really good trade continuity agreement in place that covers about 99% of the trading goods between our two countries. So that covers the vast majority of what happens and provides a really good bedrock. And in addition to that, last year the UK also acceded to CPTPP, which is the Trans-Pacific trade agreement, and that's going through a process of ratification here in Canada. But once Canada ratifies that, then trade between our two countries will also benefit from that. It is true that we've temporarily paused the free trade negotiations, but actually I think there's a huge amount that already covers what we do, and I'm confident that we will be able to move forward in the future and put in place an agreement, and an agreement that works for businesses on both sides of the Atlantic, and crucially, that builds on what we already had under the European agreement, which was the commitment we both made at the start of this, that we would build on that.
You know, Janet Yellen, of course, famously quoted the idea of friendshoring. Yeah. And so much of our focus here in Canada has been continental trade between the United States, but we have this historic relationship with the United Kingdom. How important do you see the Canada-UK relation in terms of setting an example, not only about friendshoring, but also the strength of an international rules-based order?
I think this is one of the most important things about our relationship. We are, collectively, we're the only two countries who are a member of NATO, a member of the Five Eyes, a member of the G7, and a member of the Commonwealth. There's no other two countries who are in all of those groupings, and that matters because of what it actually says about us. It talks to our core values and how we see the world. And I think that I'm constantly struck when I'm here, I've been posted in a number of countries around the world, that there is no other country in the world that I think we are culturally more similar to. The way that we operate, the way that we think about things, the emphasis on democracy, values, fairness, all of that is right at the heart of both how the UK operates and how Canada operates. It's one of the delightful things about doing business with Canada, and it's what businesses say to me all the time, that that commonality of how we see the world and how we approach things is one of the hallmarks of this relationship.
Hi, Commissioner. I really appreciate the time. Thank you for this today.
Thank you.
And that is our program for this weekend. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. I'm Michael Serapio. We'll see you again next time.